Hi, everyone, and welcome to Dogs Unknown. I'm Sarah Frazier. I'm here with co-host Brian Burton, and really looking forward to the conversation we're going to have today. We'll introduce you to our guests in just a moment, but to set this up a little bit, you know, one of our core values at Instinct is that dogs are family, because that's how we view them. And we know that for many people listening, that's the way you view them as well. But one of the important things to remember is that dogs are also captive animals, and we get them largely to serve our human wants and needs for companionship, for protection, for other very human-centric functions. And in this way, one might argue that dogs are more like glorified cattle. Really, just we created them and we get them and we keep them almost entirely for our own benefit. And I'm sure that's raising some hackles out there. It makes me uncomfortable to even say it, but I think it's an important thing for us to consider and talk through. So that's why we're having this conversation today. And we are joined by Jessica Schulte, who is the Director of Behavior and Training at Instinct East Harlem and also a dog behavior consultant, and by Lauren Spratlin of Instinct Nashville. And super excited to have you both here to talk through what might sometimes be a little bit of an uncomfortable conversation, but invited Jessica and Lauren both on because I know you both care a lot and are really interested in meeting dogs' needs and providing outlets for natural behaviors and recognizing dogs as, you know, the species and the individuals that they are. So we thought you'd be great guests to have this conversation with. So welcome. We're really happy that you're both here.
Thank you.
Good. So jumping right in, do you consider your own dogs to be family members?
I certainly do.
Of course.
Not super surprised by that answer. I would say that, Brian, you
the
and
end
I...
end of the episode, right?
Done. Dogs are family members. Shortest Dogs Unknown episode ever. Not at all surprising. I think we do as well. So I guess I would, one of the things that's important if we're viewing dogs as family members is remembering that sort of that dependent piece. They're dependent family members. They really rely on us to meet their needs. But one of the questions that comes to mind for myself that I almost have to challenge myself on when I think, hey, yes, I view my dog as family, is often, small infants aside, part of being a family member is generally having some level of responsibility toward the other members of your family unit. So I have the question is, do dogs have family responsibilities, or should they, or can they, if they're considered a family member?
I wonder if for dogs, maybe the language that might be more accurate would be, do they have clear boundaries that they understand and make sense to them and doesn't cause more anxiety? We can't ask them to go shopping for us. if we have sheep, we could ask them to herd if they were up for that kind of task. But in terms of responsibility, it's hard to ask somebody to have responsibility for something they didn't ask to have. I don't even know if that makes sense, but I think there are things we expect from our companion animals. We don't want dogs to bite when they're frustrated. We don't want dogs to jump up on the table and help themselves to our dinner. So maybe in that light, their responsibilities are understanding human rules and human customs, even though they might not make much sense to them. Why would you ever leave food out if it wasn't for me to eat? I don't know. But maybe that's how we should look at it.
It's an, I don't have an answer, truthfully. I appreciate hearing that perspective.
It's, yeah.
Lauren, what do you think?
I just to kind of run with that, I mean, it's huge to have very clear expectations. And that should go both ways, you know, like we want, you know, predictability, because the human world is so weird for a dog. So teaching them, you know, what we expect of them. And if that requires, like, you know, training and teaching skills, like doing that work with them, making it to where they can succeed in our environment, and just being as clear as we can back and forth, like, you know, this in this context, we do this. This time of day, we do this. you know, that's, I feel like that's a really important matter of just respect.
So it's interesting because when I hear both of you share those thoughts, and I agree with them wholeheartedly, like it's so important to help our dogs understand how to exist in our human world and what, where the boundaries are and, you know, what to do and what we would prefer they didn't do. To me, a lot of what I heard is actually human responsibility. I don't know if I would extend that to saying the dog is responsible for adhering to those boundaries. It's more that we're responsible for enforcing those boundaries. And I don't think there's a right answer here. I think my personal view that I used to view wildly differently is I've sort of settled on my dog has zero responsibility to me in this relationship. That doesn't mean I don't have expectations about their behavior that I'm going to sort of follow through on and uphold boundaries, but that I'm the one that bears the, I don't want to say burden, but sort of the burden of responsibility for maintaining the relationship, for meeting their needs, for, you know, making sure they have what they need to succeed. And I wasn't at that place, I would say, even 3 years ago.
Yeah.
But I think I am now. Brian, do you have thoughts?
Yeah. I mean, this topic in general, honestly, I think I've been, not this specific question, but this whole conversation we're having today, I think I've been grappling with this for a decade. And I think one of my regrets, definitely, especially the way I would frame this to clients in the past is like, you know, your dog's responsibility to the family is that when someone comes over, they go lay on their bed or they go behind the gate or they do whatever. And I would sort of frame it that way. Hmm. And I would never really do that anymore. Even though I think the point of it was just to usually was to help people who had issues with setting boundaries with their dogs, that it was like, it's okay to ask them to do certain things for us. But I think that framing, it puts the responsibility on the dog, and that's not fair. At the same time, we're all social animals and we all live together. So I think the way I think about it now is, you know, what sort of, you know, boundaries are we setting for our canine family member and making sure that we are consistent and predictable about what we're doing? Like, I still want obviously the same outcome. Like, I don't think any of us wants, you know, things to be chaotic or the dog can just do whatever passes through their minds. Cause I know I have a couple dogs where things that pass through their minds are not great ideas for a whole bunch of reasons. So I think all of that's important. But at the same time, like you said, they didn't ask to be a part of our family. Like, they didn't ask for these responsibilities. And a lot of times the types of things we think about giving them, as Jessica alluded to, makes no sense from a dog perspective. You know, when we have a species that evolved for so long being scavengers or whatever, like the things that we expect of them is not really fair. And I think it's really, really important to always, like, even though we think of them as family members, is definitely thinking of them that they are a different species. They perceive things very differently. And it's really important for us to recognize that. And I think appreciate that and keeping that top of mind.
Yeah, I would agree with that. So yeah, but I started off with a hard question, but it's what comes to mind when I think about mm-hmm. family. It's something that's evolved in my thinking over time for sure. But that being said, since I still view my dog as a family member, just a family member without responsibilities. And I think one thing I wanted to note, I know if folks are listening, they're like, well, my kids didn't ask to be a part of the family either, or I didn't ask to be a part of my family either. I think potentially the difference with dogs is they can't leave. They don't grow up and you know, spread their wings and fly away. They're sort of that forever dependent. And so it is a different dynamic and relationship there that I think is important to keep in mind. But that being said, what are the upsides do we feel like to, like, what are the benefits to dogs of us viewing them as family members? Like, what do they get out of it for us taking on this view of them being a part of the family?
I mean, I think we've seen drastic changes in generally the way that people do approach their relationships with their dogs in the past 50-100 years, getting pup cups and car rides and sleeping in the human bed, all of those things. You know, it did not look like that.
Well, on the very basic need, when we bring dogs into our homes, right, they're getting health care, they're getting fed, they're getting water, they get shelter. I think it looks different in different parts of the country and different families. Some people consider their dogs families and they might live in a kennel outside. In the city, definitely dogs are more apartment, indoor-based pets who go outside for walks and to relieve themselves. I think dogs get cared for the way dependents get cared for, right? Like the way young children get cared for is that these things are happening for you. We are taking, I was going to say responsibility. We're taking all the responsibility for making sure you have the food when you, the food that you need when you're hungry and water available and you either have your bed or you have our bed or, but those basic needs are provided for them. They don't, like wild, unlike wild animals, they don't have to go looking for those things to feel safe.
Yeah.
I think that's definitely true. I guess what I would push on or ask you to go a step further there is that we could argue that those benefits might also be bestowed upon other sort of captive animals who aren't necessarily viewed as family members, right? Like you're going to make sure you get the healthcare you need and you're going to be fed and you're going to have a shelter. So what's the added benefit to dogs of us viewing them as family members?
Yeah. Well, and just to touch on Lauren's point, just talking about, you know, I think you mentioned, Lauren, like the last 50 or 100 years, just how much that's changed. And I would argue even how much has changed in the past 10 years or 15 years, just like even being in this industry that long, because I do feel like more people think that way. And I think that generally implies that we're going to treat them with more kindness and understanding moving forward and not just expecting them to conform to whatever, you know, we want them to conform to, knowing that, you know, they're being forced to sort of live in our human world. I think calling them family, I do think the benefit there is that it implies that we have a responsibility for that caretaking and also like making sure that their welfare is actually being looked after and cared for. So I would say like one of the benefits of considering it that way is for those reasons. Yeah, the captive animal piece, this is the part I've been struggling with for 10 years, honestly, like inside my head. And I love dogs and I'll always have dogs, but that is that. So I don't know if we're going to get there in a second, I'll wait to actually talk about that part. But I do want to get into that once we get there.
Absolutely. I think that'll be the meat of our conversation as we move forward. But I would say that for myself, if I think about the upsides for of folks viewing dogs as family members, and we think about all the like incredible dog owners who come and see us, right, that we all know who come in, I think there's that view and the kind of deeper bond and relationship that that fosters for the human also makes it more likely that someone is going to say, hey, you're struggling, or hey, you're having a behavior issue, let's see how we can get you some help, versus automatically jumping to like, I need a new, no diss against cows, but like, you know, right. But like your decision-making process in terms of the level of support that you offer them from a training and behavior level is probably quite different potentially because you're viewing them as a family member. Hey, you're struggling. I'm going to commit to seeing you through these hard times because you're thinking of them as a family member. That connection and that bond is probably going to be deeper than if we just looked at them as a captive animal.
I'm sorry I interrupted, but I was just thinking like it's the same as committing to puppy classes, right? Like you coming into my family, I'm going to make sure that you grow up to be a well-adjusted, happy, confident dog, or doing any kind of dog sports or any kind of trick training. I would say a lot of captive animals don't have that kind of interaction with their keepers. Zoo animals may, because of husbandry. Trainers may take time to work with them and teach them things in order to make their health care easier. But I don't know if other animals who are captive or who are being farmed have those things added into their life.
And I would say, Jessica, likely not at the same level, if anything.
Yeah.
Right.
Like the degree to which the efforts we make to do things to set them up, to like include them in our lives. And I guess the question there is still, are we doing it for them or are we doing it for us so that we can include them in our lives?
Yeah.
If it's a little bit of both, you know, then that's probably fair because relationships have, you know, there's two sides to them.
Yeah.
But for me, I think that's probably what I would see as one of the biggest benefits, in addition to some of the other reasons that we talked about. Did we miss anything there that comes to mind?
I mean, like the I, well, and just kind of, well, so I,
what are you about to say?
Well, so part of this is like the benefit of being, you know, considered family, all the benefits we talked about. And maybe that's like, you know, you get like cool beds and you get cool toys and you get to go to birthday parties, maybe even have your own birthday party with your own birthday hat and all these different things that, that we do that, like a lot of, again, is kind of, I think we just mentioned like maybe more on the human side. I think about where we grew up in Nova Scotia, like when we were kids, it was a different dog, you know, back in the 80s. Like you really didn't see people walk their dogs. You didn't see, mm-hmm. you know, like they weren't coming to birthday parties. I'll tell you that. There might be one there, but it might be bitey. But, but the other thing too, is like all the dogs, like a lot, like we used to go like after school, like we go down to like the, you know, the softball field or the baseball field to go play. And there'd be like four dogs that would follow us down, like the friends' dogs and everything. And they would follow us down and they would hang out with us and they'd come back with us and they kind of were out during the day and there was puppies everywhere and like all these different things. But like also they had a lot more autonomy and freedom. They got hurt more, they got sick more, and they didn't have like these other things. But like also at the same, just to kind of to think about like as family piece, I feel like one of the things that where that can hurt them a little bit is on the, if we view them as family, we might sometimes, we might take a more human centric view on what's actually best for them.
Yeah, definitely. So I think that's, if we want to move into that next piece.
Yeah.
If we think we've sort of captured what are the benefits, mm-hmm. then Brian, you've already started to talk about this, but what are the downsides? Should we really be calling dogs family members? Are we doing them a disservice by calling them family members or viewing them as family members? What are the arguments against?
Well, I'll just finish my thoughts since we were there, and then Jessica and Lauren, you can let me know if you disagree. But yeah, I think the risk is, the downside is that when thinking about their welfare and their experience in life, if we're taking a too human centric view, it's possible that we could actually be negatively impacting their welfare and their quality of life. It's like probably like the biggest reason. And that's why I think it's not necessarily thinking of them as family per se, that's the problem. I think it's just more, unfortunately, like a lot of things, there's nuance to stuff, and it's a family member of a different species who sees the world completely differently than we do. And I know when we went through our graduate degree, the thing that was most eye-opening to me was things on like perception, like how do animals see the world? How do they view the world? You know, what types of emotions are they actually feeling? All of those things like are very, very different. And how they would choose to go through their day or how they would choose to be a part of the family might actually look different than what we actually think about. So I don't think it's bad that we consider them part of the family because of all the benefits that we talked about. The risk is if we're viewing them as little humans. And I think that for me is where the risk comes.
Yeah, very well said. I'm sure we can expand on that quite a bit, but I would agree wholeheartedly that I think that's, it's just sort of a default again, that if we think about family, our default is to think of members of the same species. So if we're thinking about dogs as family members, then yes, it's just so easy to lose sight of them as a different species with their own set of needs. And again, lose sight of the fact that they are captive animals.
Right.
And all that that entails, where they are so reliant on us to meet those needs. And I love that, Lauren, you mentioned that. I mean, I don't know a dog that doesn't love a pup cup. So that's a great example of like fun for dogs and fun for humans. Yeah. But some of the other stuff, like the, you know, like the birthday party hat and the, you know, I don't know what, like other types of things that we do for them, that sometimes I think it's very easy for people to, if things aren't going well, if maybe their dog is struggling or having certain behavior issues, it's hard not to almost feel resentment or frustration toward your dog if you're viewing them as a family member and you're from your viewpoint saying, I do all of this for you. Mm-hmm. I take you through the drive-through to get pup cups. I throw you a birthday party. I, you know, bring you to drop you off at the kids' school. I dress you up in the finest clothes, you know, and my dogs have coats. So no, like there's no shade thrown there.
I got you a Casper mattress.
Right. And so it feels like, how could you not, you know, I'm doing everything for you and you might be doing a ton, but it might not actually be what your dog needs or what's most meaningful to them because they're a different species.
Yeah. I mean, what comes into my mind is, you know, working in Nashville, we have more and more condos every single day and people are moving in with their dogs. And, you know, it's getting to be a much busier city. And that's, you know, we have a lot of those clients and it's hard sometimes to go in there and you look at a certain dog and the whole setup and you're like, this is just, you know, incredibly difficult from the start. And they think, you know, they're like, well, I fell in love with this dog. I got this dog. Everybody has dogs in condos and cities and, you know, don't really know what they're getting into. And as much as people want to treat their dog like a family member, you know, there are sometimes where I don't usually say it, but sometimes I'm like, your dog would just be so much happier somewhere else.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, the environment's
it's a hard question.
It's a really hard question. And us being in New York City, sort of cut you off there, but just mention, because we're all from New York City. So 99% of the dogs that we train every year are in condos and apartment buildings. And I think it's easy for us to lose sight of that sometimes. And just because we're like, well, people just can't pick, like where are you going to move to with a backyard in New York City? Like, unless you move out of this. And we've had people move out of the city or buy homes outside the city and do that. But I think that's a really good point is like, yeah, I just wanted to add that there that, you know, we work with lots of dogs, obviously in condos and apartment buildings and everything, but they're for some dogs with certain issues or certain whatever, that's a really challenging environment for them to be in.
I was just thinking, working with this wonderful woman and her recently adopted dog, and she came because she came to Instinct because she was confused that her dog seemed really friendly, but then would snarl when people would pet the dog or would bend down to say hello to the dog. And she wants and needs this dog to be able to go with her places and be in a variety of different situations where people, other humans are going to notice this very pretty dog and want to interact with her. And it was so much fun having the conversation with her about, well, does your dog want to say hello? And her realizing that her dog was totally fine with saying, hey, nice to meet you, but I'm going to hang here. And that was mm-hmm. fine. You know, like her dog didn't need to be loved on, didn't need like intense interaction from everybody. But it was just such a lovely example of a human expecting her dog, who she loves more than anything. This is a wonderful guardian of her dog, but just it took her a minute to think, oh, this isn't about what I want, like, or what I think she should do, or what good manners are. It's setting my dog up to feel comfortable so she can be in these situations. And I think that's a really nice example of like how family members and expectations from a human to a canine, in the best meaning intentions, can kind of come into conflict with each other that way. Like, I do think she is still bringing her dog places. She actually just sent me video of her dog just hanging out next to her while she was doing things. And the dog was perfectly happy and lovely. And she had a little mat for her. But I think sometimes just taking a step back and looking at your dog as a dog and an individual can make all that difference.
Yeah. I don't know. What does that family member actually want? I think instead of assuming we know what they want just because they're part of the family, or it's like,
or that they fit that niche of sort of what we've envisioned the family dog to be,
yes,
and what they should and shouldn't be able to do. Because they've sort of transitioned from this. Yeah, it's like the family dog to the dog is family, but we haven't quite gotten there yet mm-hmm. some of the time, I think. So I love that example, Jessica. And I think the coolest thing that is evident in that is like, yeah, your client, like she does view her dog as family because she wasn't, you know, it's a different species. We can't be expected to, you know, a lot of this isn't intuitive in terms of like reading the situation and the dog and how things are, how they're feeling and all of that appropriately. But I think the coolest thing with that example, and it's just an example of how much people love their dogs and the argument for saying like, yeah, they are family, is she knew and she learned and she was like, oh, I can make you, I can help you feel a whole lot more comfortable and be way more successful and still honor the things that I are important to me in my life, but include you in them in a way that's appropriate, more appropriate for both of us. So yeah, it's just a really neat example.
Yeah. What was really funny is as we were talking, she was like, I do this with my kids. Why didn't I think about doing this for my dog?
Yeah.
And it just furthers that family connection. But I, you know, the dogginess sometimes and our expectation of what it means to be a dog sometimes just needs to be tweaked a little bit.
Yeah. Well, and I think that opens up the conversation. So I do want to talk a little bit about ways that people can really, if you're viewing your dog as a family member, guard against that sort of human-centric, like, what do they want from a human point of view and how do we honor them as a different species and meet their needs? But I do, just for argument's sake, after talking about this, does anyone feel like, are there alternate ways of viewing a relationship with dogs that feels more appropriate or that sets us up to do a better job meeting their needs? Should we be calling them something other than a family member?
Well, again, this whole thing grappling with the last 10 years, I mean, there's a part of me that feels like captive animal is actually a better term.
For the dog.
For the dog. Now, that doesn't sound great, right? So let me explain. But the reality is, like, if we think about our dogs, like, and even, you know, when we're trying to do the best we can and give them choice and use positive reinforcement and meeting their needs, the reality is, like, if I think about our dog, like, they don't really choose when they go out to the bathroom. They don't choose when they eat. They don't choose when they go for walks. Now, of course, they can ask for these things and we can do that. But in general, they're going to follow a schedule that we are actually setting. Like, they have they don't get to decide to go out and mate with the local dog. Like, there's a whole host of things that they cannot do, and they would not be able to survive unless we were doing that. And if you were an alien, like, you know, up in the sky looking down, I don't know, besides the fact they live in our home, you probably couldn't tell much of a difference between like a well-run zoo and what we're doing for our dogs. And to be perfectly honest, I grapple with that sometimes, because if I really try to, you know, look at the ethical argument of like having a dog, and, you know, to your point, Lauren, with the, like the condos and apartment buildings, like, is that an ideal place for a dog? For most dogs, no. Like, that is not ideal. And we are putting that on them because that's where we live. And we've had dogs in apartments for years. So again, we help. And there's lots of dogs who can thrive in that situation, but there's lots of dogs who can't. And I think it's really, I think there's a benefit to sometimes like understand, because for me, it helps me understand my dogs, especially if they're struggling with something or there's something going on, or I need to, you know, do something else that maybe I don't feel like doing in order to sort of help them have either a higher quality of life or those types of things. And it, for me, it helps give me a better understanding. And that's not that, again, like, dogs have, you know, evolved to be around humans and they seek out humans. And, you know, there are dogs where, like, you know, they can go from one home to another home, like, it's no big deal. And they're super comfortable, sort of, like, you know, so again, like, they are different than, you know, a panther, right? Like, they're going to see humans differently. They're going to like, you know, well, I'm sure they would like a popsicle too. But like, but in terms of like day-to-day interactions, they're not going to get enjoyment out of it. And I know dogs get so much enjoyment, or at least some do, like being around humans and all those things. But for me, like, I find I frequently have to take a step back and remember, like, essentially they are captive animals. And that for me helps me sort of understand them at a level where I feel like I can have more empathy for them, especially if they're doing stuff that I just find annoying. Like, I mean, I do this for a living. There's certain things my dogs do I find annoying or frustrating. Like, it's not,
or
like
gross.
Or gross. Like, when you hear that licking sound, or like, you know, there's all kinds of things that happen that you're just like, this is, yeah, gross. But at the same time, again, they're a captive animal. They're different. So like all those things. So I, you know, I I'm sure someone will cut this and me calling, you know, dogs captive animals, because it's sort of, and I remember the first time I heard this, and I remember conversations at a number of years ago at like a behavior conference having this conversation. I remember we had this conversation and brought it up, and it really rubbed some folks the wrong way. Mm-hmm. But I find it hard to see the counter argument that they're really not. So, and again, knowing that dogs are different and they've evolved differently than wild animals and they're domesticated, like all of that. So recognizing all that, and they're still captive.
Like any other domesticated.
Yes.
Captive animal. Yeah. I would agree with that. And I think it's one of those, like, maybe it's not an all or nothing, like yes, no situation. Mm-hmm. And I love, Jessica, you mentioned this word earlier, like close to the beginning of when we started, but I do, this has evolved over time. I first and foremost, I find it really helpful. I do just sort of think of like, I am my dog's keeper. Mm. They are totally at the mercy of me to do right by them. Right? Like to understand their needs as a species and what they need as an individual, and to provide the right environment and to foster that relationship they need to help them like thrive and succeed in their captive environment, which is my house, which is our house. And I think further to that point of like, because I'm my dog's keeper, we talked about this earlier, I'm the only one in that relationship who has responsibilities. Like my dog really owes me nothing. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean they're allowed to do whatever they want, but they don't owe me anything. Just like, you know, like a captive zebra or a cow or a goat or a chicken doesn't owe their keeper anything. Mm-hmm. And then I think secondly, I view them more as like, I am your parent or your guardian or your friend, right? And I am going to like foster a secure attachment, and I'm going to build a relationship, and we're going to do all the like fun family things. But I think if I almost have to think about them in that order, because it does, to your point, Brian, like, it forces me into that empathetic, like, oh shoot, like I'm responsible. I'm wholly responsible for this being that's in my home. And I need to do right by them because there's no one else to do it.
Yeah.
This whole conversation kind of comes back to language. And I find that the words we use are really meaningful and powerful. And I struggle honestly with what to call myself. Like, I totally agree with everything you were saying, Sarah, 3,000%. But I know sometimes, like, I'll shorthand and I'll say, like, if I'm talking about people I'm working with, I'll refer to them as the dog's parent or the mom or the dad, because it's, for me, it's a shorthand. It's easy to use that word to mean you are an adult human who is caring for this animal, and that animal goes home with you at the end of the day. But I'm not comfortable using, like, personally, I'm not comfortable with using those words for me. I don't refer to myself as my dog's mom, but I also can't stand owner. Like, that feels, even though legally I am, like, that doesn't feel right to me either. Guardian feels like a mouthful. It's probably the most accurate, but that does not fly off my tongue. I'm just wondering how everybody else deals with like naming your relationship.
Yeah. I struggle with this too. I find it so hard. I haven't really found the right word. And I think that's why we've started even in like social media and things like that to say like, this is Fluffy's human is doing an amazing job, right? Like they're your dog and you're their human. Yeah. Right. So, and just, so it's just, that's what the relationship is like, an interspecies relationship, and you're their human. I don't know if that works, but that's sort of where I've landed.
Yeah.
I know that doesn't connote a specific relationship, so that's challenging.
Yeah, I've used that as well, and I feel most comfortable with that.
Yeah.
Oh, it's just such a weird dynamic, that kind of dual, you're my family member, you're captive, and according to the law, I own you.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's a little bizarre. And I know for me, for us, like, again, when we were going through and doing our, I'm bringing up our graduate work, because honestly, this for us, I think, shaped a lot of how we think about this. But I remember at that time, I was, let's just say, more opinionated about a lot of things back in my, you know, 10 years ago. And in our program, there's a lot of dog people. There are people doing, you know, behavior research or cognitive research with animals. And there were a ton of people from like the Bronx Zoo, like who actually you know, work with all the different mm-hmm. animals and do. And for me at that time, I mean, I'm still uncomfortable with zoos for various reasons. Without totally respecting that, there's lots of people care a lot about those animals and all of those things. All those caveats.
Complicated issue.
Very complicated issue. But I'm much more at this point. I'm much more open minded to kind of hear things. I know there's lots of people who care about that. But I think one of the things that when I think back to that and I remember what impacted me was when I actually heard about how do they actually set up like welfare and routines and everything for the penguins and for the giraffes and knowing there's a big difference between prey versus like apex predators and all those types of things and what kind of welfare you can provide. But like when they actually went through and talked about like what they did, I was like, doesn't sound very different than what I'm doing with Sammy and Buster. And, mm-hmm. and that hit me. And that's what I've been thinking about for the past 10 years. Like that when I realized like what they're doing, they care just as much like about the people we were, so many of them cared so much about what they were doing and what they were setting up. And I had a emotional response to, you know, captive animals and captive wild animals for a whole host of reasons. But when I look at it, say, yes, like dogs are domesticated, but still the routines and how I'm viewing me being a good owner or a good parent or a good whatever is similar to what they're calling it. And that has been stuck in my head ever since. And I can't get it out.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think it's the hard thing with dogs is because they've sort of evolved alongside us for so long and because they're so incredibly good at just sort of cobbling it together and figuring out how to put up with us. And because for some reason they like us. It's easy to sort of shortchange them because they are happy to see us and they do just love us. They do a better job loving us sometimes than we do loving them, you know, truly, like without sort of boundaries and restrictions about how we need to behave in order for them to love us still. But I think it makes it easy for us to not be pushed to learn about them as a species and to not be pushed to learn about like, what do you need to be a happy dog or a happy cattle dog or a happy hound? Because we can quote unquote, like we can get away with it, right? Yeah. If they have a soft couch to lay on and they get to go out and pee and maybe run around a little bit for a little bit every day, like most of the dogs get by because they've figured out how to do it. That doesn't mean that's optimal or even close to optimal in terms of what we actually could be doing for them to make them be like a fully realized sort of happy individual of their species. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it kind of amazes me as just a culture as a whole, how little we know about meeting dogs' individual, unique needs. You know, I mean, it's so gratifying in doing dog training when you can explain to someone, like, take your dog on, you know, a decompression walk twice a week. Your dog likes sniffing, being able to point out things like, hey, your dog is really getting a lot out of this activity. Let's do a little bit more of this. And then, you know, we start to watch anxieties kind of just trickle off and they're like, whoa, you know, like,
and it's not like they didn't care. They just didn't know. Cause it's not, it's not common knowledge. It's not intuitive.
And I would say that even to some degree, like how often like even kids are parents. I'm thinking about with dogs sort of that lens of like, well, but my dog is supposed to heal on a walk, right? Like I'm supposed to teach them how to walk close by my side. And that's what they're supposed to do. And that's what part of being a good dog owner is. And that's what part of being a good, well-adjusted dog is. And I think it's sort of realizing like, hey, actually they don't need to be in a heel all the time. There's nothing wrong with teaching that skill. Right. But like it goes beyond that. And I think in some ways, even there's trends toward that in parenting human children as well, right? Like you don't have to shut down the big feelings, maybe understand why they're happening and give them tools to deal with it. And kids need to run and move their bodies and play and all that kind of stuff. So I like that example a lot, Lauren.
Me too.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like it a lot too. And the reality is like, again, our culture has taught us to prioritize other things. And it's not because people don't care. It's a lot of people just don't know. And why would you know?
Yeah.
You know?
So that being said, since we know that anyone listening to this really loves their dog and does likely view them as a family member to some degree or another. What are some things that we can do to kind of honor them as dogs and as a different species and individuals, and make sure we can help us kind of shift out of that, again, that like human-centric view of viewing them as like a little furry human? Yeah. What are some, like, I don't know, activities that people could focus on, or what are some things that people should really learn to set themselves up to view their dogs as like the best version of a family member possible, right? Like a family member of a different species who is dependent on them to meet their needs.
Yeah.
I'd say really figure out what your dog likes and what your dog doesn't like. You know, they give us a lot of subtle information about, like, you know, I love a raspberry. I hate spinach. I like sniffing walks. You know, I don't like walking at this time of day. It's too loud. It's weird. And giving them as much choice and control as is safe, you know, and that'll build trust.
Yeah, I think the preferences piece is a huge one.
Yeah, preferences and listening.
And listening, yeah.
I feel like so much communication actually with dogs is like, it's listening. And we said it before, people always, you know, it's like, how do I be a dog whisperer? How do I talk to my dog? And it's honestly, it's like, let's learn how to listen first. Yeah. And I think that's the point I want to just make sure I point out with Lauren was on that. Cause I agree with you. It's actually first step is learning how to listen to them.
Yes.
And then a part of that is the preferences. I think you're about to talk about.
Yeah. And with the listening piece. So that would be like, if one of the, I think the biggest gifts you could give your dog is to learn about dog body language and some of the more subtle communication, because they are a different species. We are a different species. Our ethograms, or like our catalogs of behavior, are just different, right? Like, and sometimes are completely opposite of what we would expect them to be. So doing that sets you up to be in a position to listen. Because if you listen, but you don't actually understand what it is that they're saying, you know, that's not so helpful. So I think learning body language is a huge one. And then I love, Lauren, that you brought up the like raspberry versus spinach and like the sniffy walks versus the whatever, because I think sometimes it sounds so silly, but like we almost don't allow dogs their preferences.
Right.
Right. Like you should like fetch. You should like being taken to the kids' soccer game. You should like when I pet your head and like rough up your ears. Right. We just, and again, not in a malicious way. We just sort of, we don't always give them that grace and understanding. It's like, I always bring up the example, like if you tell someone you don't like tomatoes and you're immediately met with, oh, but you just have to try them this way, or you just have to try this type of tomato at the height of the summer months when it's like, just so, and you're like, I don't like tomatoes. I don't like them.
Yeah.
So if your dog doesn't like tomatoes, being like, you know, fetch or whatever, as long as it's not something that is a skill or something that they need to like navigate life successfully, or if there's not a safety issue, it's okay for them to like and not like certain things. That's totally fine. Yeah. So I love that preferences piece, because I feel like we don't fully internalize that all the time.
Yeah. And the one that resonates, and we talk about this, is like, it's like someone telling you, like, I'm going to make you like Nickelback.
Or tomatoes. That's
you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, you're not going to make me like, and I've seen the Nickelback. If there's any Nickelback fans, they seem lovely in interviews and everything. I do not
and
like.
And we're even Canadian.
And we're Canadian. And I don't like that music. So, but like, no one's going to convince me to like Nickelback. So like, if I was like abducted by an alien and it was, they thought, well, like lots of people like Nickelback. I mean, they're a huge band. Like, you must love Nickelback. So like, they play Nickelback for me all the time.
You're like, what's wrong with Brian?
Right. Well, maybe we should do some counter conditioning to Nickelback. We'll get him some pizza and we'll listen to Nickelback.
Right? Maybe just play different music.
Yeah, right. Yeah, just try differently, you know. Yeah. Put on Green Day or Nirvana for me. I'm going to be really, you don't even need to get me pizza. Like, I'm going to be good. I'll sit there for hours. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah. So I love that. The like listening and equip yourself with the knowledge to be able to listen. Really kind of, and then once you know that, looking for and paying attention to your dog's preferences. And then I love those as two huge ones, truthfully. What are some other things?
About?
In terms of just sort of helping people like, really honor their dogs as a different species. If we're viewing them as family, how do we honor them as a different species and really make sure we're working to meet those needs?
Mm-hmm. I think looking at some natural behaviors, right? What, and then again, like big picture, and then drill down to what your individual dog would prefer. But doing things like ripping up boxes or really cheap safe toys or searching for kibble around the house, letting them use their nose to do more structured activities. I'm a nose work instructor, so of course I'm going to go there, but letting them be dogs in the most supportive, safe, healthy way we can. And it doesn't mean they have to chew up our couches or they go, you know, like, but setting them up so they can have those outlets. It must be so confusing for dogs who, and of course, sometimes you have to get from point A to point B, and that's different. But for dogs who are constantly pulled away from sniffing things because we feel that what they're sniffing is gross or yucky, or we don't understand why they stop to sniff that corner of the sidewalk. I can't not read. You know, like if I'm walking down the street, I read signs without even realizing I'm reading them. And if I was walking with someone who kept covering my eyes, like, don't do that. That would be so incredibly frustrating, difficult, confusing for me. So I think when we take away the ability for dogs to do those sniffy walks, it's got to be the same. Like, I have no idea what's going on in the world. Why won't you let me figure out what just happened here or who just stopped here or what fell here? That's helpful information to me as I put together the information about my environment that I'm in.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the bigger sort of picture that you talked about there, Jessica, is also taking time to like actually understand them as a species.
Yeah.
Right. Like, what are some important natural behaviors of dogs? And then maybe drilling down further, if you have a certain breed who was bred for like a really specific function, maybe understanding that as well. But, you know, as a species, and you touched on a big one, you know, smell and olfactory like information is to them, I don't think there's a direct comparison there, but like, if our primary sense is sight to navigate the world, like, it's at least close to that for dogs in terms of smell, mm-hmm. you know, like that's mm-hmm. just such a, so that's a huge one is yeah. allowing them to use their nose and explore using their nose and gather information using their nose. And then as a species too, knowing that like, what's important to dogs? For most dogs, it's like, it is sniffing. It is like having the chance to chew or gnaw. It is the chance for some dogs to be able to like dig mm-hmm. or to shred things. Play is hugely important. That's usually one we check off the bark. Box because we love to play too.
Yeah.
Right. Bark is that's a lot of times how they're going to convey information or convey emotion. There's a whole bunch of reasons for why barking can occur. But certainly it's a normal behavior.
Yeah. The reason why I bring that one up is I do feel like that one just gets overlooked as it being like a natural thing. And like, I know there's dogs who bark. There's lots of dogs who bark because they're anxious or nervous. There are some dogs who do just like to bark. And it doesn't mean like sure. if you don't like it, we can't work on it. But like, I think that's one thing we just overlook all the time because we find it so inherently annoying as humans.
Even though we selected them to do it for quite a long time because it was really handy to have an alert system. But that alert system I know can go off the rails a little bit in our modern life.
Yeah.
But
and it can be stressful to them.
For sure.
Well, sometimes.
But, and then also I think the other one that sometimes folks don't know about quite as much is that opportunity for just restful observation. So don't feel like you always have to be actively doing something with your dog. Like sometimes one of the best activities you can do with your dog to just kind of honor them as a dog is go find a comfy spot on the grass or on your front porch or anywhere else and just sit there together and let them look at things. Because dogs who are maybe like street dogs or, you know, wild canids, things like that, like spend a lot of time just hanging out, not asleep, right? Just hanging out awake and kind of watching the world go by and resting. So I think that's another huge one that sometimes people aren't as familiar with. But I think those are big ones to be aware of.
I would also add in, I think it's also important when we can and appropriate to give them choice. Like, so like if they're just hanging out in the house, you know, do they have multiple potential activities that they can do at certain times? I'm not saying you always have to do this, but like, do they have option like the comfy bed to lay on and they have like their toy box and then like there's whatever other activities we're going to do or like going out on a walk, for example, like sometimes it's important that if your dog wants to go left, but usually go right, but they want to go left, like go with them, like start giving them some, and maybe even in the beginning, they don't even know that you're following them or they have that choice. But if you're consistent about giving them some options or outlets for choices. Like they do learn that, like, hey, I actually have some control over this at times. So that would be the other thing I think I would add in.
Yeah. And I think, Lauren, you mentioned that was sort of first and foremost for you as well.
Yes,
it's
exactly.
Just that importance of choice and control. And I love that you caveated that with when it's safe to do so.
Yeah.
Right. What's not the suggestion of just like throwing choice, and sometimes too much choice is stressful.
It is.
But yeah. Offering choice and control in safe, appropriate situations is huge mm-hmm. for anyone, but certainly hugely important for a captive animal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Gizmo. I have a boxer named Gizmo, and he, speaking of barking, loves to, and he'll do it like a couple times a week. Go over to our side porch and just bark and bark and bark and bark. Our neighbor loves him, knows him. She'll come out. She brings him toys. And this is just like, and I'm like, if my clients knew that this happened at my house, they'd be like, this is out of control. But it's like, you know, we have certain hours where we know that it can happen. But, you know, it's a fun game. I'm like, okay, he wants to see Kiki, you know, like.
Yeah. Well, I love that example too, because it is to your point, like it happens in a certain situation. I'm sure if you really needed to, you could like call him away and say, buddy, let's go inside. We can't bark right now.
Yeah.
Right. But within that, it's like a wonderful outlet for him to do a behavior that's important to him that he really enjoys. And I'm smiling ear to ear because like boxers are one of my absolute favorite all-time breeds. So anything that they do generally, I'm going to find really cute. So I'm like, hee-hee, boxers outside barking. But I think that's such a great example for people to hear. Yeah. Good. Well, I think that this was definitely a interesting sort of thought-provoking conversation. I do think that sort of conversation-wise, I'm definitely made me sort of think and push and explore certain opinions I had a little bit more, and I hope it'll do the same for people who are listening. And if you strongly disagree with certain things that certain ones of us said, that's allowed. I'm sure there's certain points that each of us made here that we disagree with one another. You know, I don't think this is a black and white issue by any means, but I do think it's an important one to explore because we care so much about our dogs and love them so much, and because they're such a meaningful part of our lives.
Yeah.
That if having conversations like this can help us just do a little bit better for them, I think it's worth it.
Yeah.
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 Well, thank you both so much for coming on and chatting with us. And we'll see you next time.